from a book that I really like, if any of you are interested.
But you're going to have to speak a little
louder. Okay. Touch of the Earth, and it's by T.C. McLuhan. And if any of you are interested in looking at it, it's basically quotations from spiritual leaders and famous Indian people in history. And since I'm going to be talking about Native American religion, past and present, I want to share some perspectives and quotations from this book. Chief Seattle is one of my favorite orators. And this is what he said: "To us, the ashes of our ancestors are sacred, and their resting place is hallowed ground." Because we are going to be talking about burial sites and sacred sites of Indian tribes. This was by Chief Plenty Coo, who gives a farewell address in 1909 at the Little Bighorn Council Grounds in Montana, which now, of course, you may know that that was Custer's battlefield, and through legislation congressionally, that was changed to the Little Bighorn Battlefield as of last year. And Plenty Coo was a very famous Crow chief. "The ground on which we stand is sacred ground. It is the dust and blood of our ancestors. On these plains, the great white father at Washington sent his soldiers armed with long knives and rifles to slay the Indian. Many of them sleep on yonder hill where Pahaska, white chief of the long hair, General Custer, so bravely fought and fell. A few more passing sons will see us here no more. And our dust and bones will mingle with these same prairies. I see in a vision the dying spark of our council fires, the ashes cold and white. I see no longer the curling smoke rising from our lodge poles. I hear no longer the songs of the women as they prepare the meal. The antelope have gone. The buffalo wallows are empty. Only the wail of the coyote is heard. The white man's medicine is stronger than ours. His iron horse rushes over the buffalo trail. He talks to us through his whispering spirit, the telephone. We are like the birds with a broken wing. My heart is cold within me. My eyes are growing dim. I am old." I have passed out, or I have Mark Kremen, who is a resource person for me today. We'll be talking about some of the issues, religious issues in the Northwest. The Snoqualmie Falls, which is a sacred site for the tribes in the Northwest, and many of the other issues that he's been involved in through the church. One thing that I believe is significant and will kind of set the stage for us is a reading of a declaration that was given to the spiritual leaders in the Indian communities in the state of Washington and the Eskimos in the Pacific Northwest, an apology by the mainline denominations. And I have passed this out for reading. So if the people who have that would begin reading the apology.
"Dear brothers and sisters, this is a formal apology on behalf of our churches for their long-standing participation in the destruction of traditional Native American spiritual practices. We call upon our people for recognition of and respect for your traditional ways of life and for protection of your sacred places and ceremonial objects. We have frequently been unconscious and insensitive and have not come to your aid when you have been victimized by unjust federal policies and practices. In many other circumstances, we reflected the rampant racism and prejudice of the dominant culture with which we too willfully identify. During this 200th anniversary of the United States Constitution, we, as leaders of our churches in the Pacific Northwest, extend our apology. We ask for your forgiveness and blessing.
As the Creator continues to renew the earth, the plants, the animals, and all living things, we call upon the people of our denominations and fellowships to a commitment of mutual support in your efforts to reclaim and protect the legacy of your own traditional spiritual teachings. To that end, we pledge our support and assistance in upholding the American Indian Religious Freedom Act, and within that legal precedent, affirm the following.
The rights of the Native peoples to practice and participate in traditional ceremonies and rituals with the same protection offered all religions under the Constitution. 2. Access to and protection of sacred sites and public lands for ceremonial purposes. 3. The use of religious symbols, feathers, tobacco, sweetgrass, bone, etc., for use in traditional ceremonies and rituals.
Do you want to read again?
Do you want to finish the last part of it? Thank you.
The spiritual power of the land and the ancient wisdom of your indigenous religions can be, we believe, great gifts to the Christian churches. We offer our communities our commitment to support you in the righting of previous wrongs, to protect your people's efforts to enhance Native spiritual teachings, to encourage the members of our churches to stand in solidarity with you on these important religious issues, to provide advocacy and mediation, when appropriate, for ongoing negotiations with state agencies and federal officials regarding these matters.
Okay.
May the promises of this day go on public record with all congregations of our communions and be communicated to the Native American peoples of the Pacific Northwest. May the God of Abraham and Sarah and the Spirit who lives in both the Cedar and the Salmon people be honored and celebrated. Sincerely.
Thank you. Now, this was signed by the bishops from all the mainline denominations in that area, and this was extremely significant for the Native Americans who were part of and involved in the ELCA, because, well, not just that church, but any other mainline denomination, just a recognition and affirmation of the right for Indian people and support to practice their Indian traditional religious ceremonies and practices, which brings us into the Indian Religious Freedom Act. And as I mentioned yesterday, it was illegal until 1978 for Indian people to practice any of their traditional Indian religions or dances by federal law. And it wasn't until this act was passed in 1978, which gave them religious freedom, and they could actually be imprisoned when the federal law was passed, probably in the early 1900s. There was a prison term for practicing any traditional religious ceremony. It was prohibited. So this was a victory to have the Indian Religious Freedom Act passed. And what it did, it provided access to sacred sites on federal lands, which had been prohibited. And when we talk about sacred sites, I've heard sacred up here, the word, the terminology, what this means to people that are here, that this whole valley, this whole area has a it's like sacred. There's a sense of spirit or joy, or I mean, you feel something something that's religious about being here. Well, you can maybe relate that to sacred sites that Indian tribes had visited that were very religious sites and very much a part of their ceremonies, and then to be denied access to those sites. So this Indian Religious Freedom Act allowed that on federal land. Also, it provided access to areas on federal land which had sacred substances that they used in their ceremonies for particular tribes. Now, keep in mind that there are like 500 tribes in the United States, and they all have different ceremonies that are specific for their tribe. And so their sacred sites will be different for different tribes. Like, for example, Mark will talk about the Snoqualmie Falls and some of the sacred sites and areas in Washington. I can talk in Montana. In Montana, we have there's a medicine wheel that's not very far from the Crow Reservation, and that's on federal land. And I've been very much involved in preserving that, because Indian people go there, it's like a pilgrimage. And it's not just one tribe. That medicine wheel is used by many of the Plains tribes, and I don't know, you know, how many other tribes, but many Indian people and tribes have pilgrimages to this sacred area, this medicine wheel. And they were very outraged because there was just, I mean, the Federal Forest Service wanted to pave the road up there and do all these, you know, put fences up and signs up and really commercialize it. And that has not been resolved yet. The tribes objected to commercializing the sacred site. That has caused a lot of controversy, and it has not been resolved. The Blackfeet tribe, for example, if you've been up in the Glacier Park area, Chief Mountain, which is one of the most outstanding mountains if you're going on the way up to Banff, right out of Browning, is a very significant sacred site. And the Blackfeet tribe have vision quests up there. They have pilgrimages. They actually, I don't know how they get up there, because it's like it's a huge mountain with like a plateau, and it's like just solid rock. But they have pilgrimages up there, and it's very significant. There are other sites in that reservation. Some of you may have read the controversy about the Forest Service, Congress trying to declare certain parts of Montana, the forest wilderness area, which the tribe wants so that there can't be development. On the other hand, the oil companies have oil leases up there. They want to develop this, and the tribes and environmentalists who are assisting the tribes and advocacies for wilderness areas say that any disturbance, I mean, first of all, it's a religious area, it's a sacred site, it's an area where the tribal religious leaders would go and gather substances, sacred substances that they use in their ceremonies. So right now there's just a stay on that, whether or not that will be declared a wilderness area and not opened up for exploration by the oil companies. But every tribe in Montana that I work with have a religious area. Right, there's a sacred site, the Sweetgrass Mountains, which several tribes claim as being a part of their religious and sacred sites for prayer and pilgrimage. So the Indian Religious Freedom Act will allow now the tribes to go into the federal land, but there really isn't any enforcement. And in fact, there was a case that I believe it went to the Supreme Court in California, where I can't remember what tribe it was, did not want a Forest Service road going through some area.
Gold Road.
Yes. and they lost on that. So then, of course, another case that affected Indian religious freedom is what went to the Supreme Court involving the use of peyote in the Native American Church. Now, the Native American Church is a group probably started in the Southwest, I'm assuming, but it is national. It's a national church organization of Indian people, various tribes. Not all Indian people embrace the Native American Church, because in the tribes we have many Indian people that are Christian. I would say probably 50% would say they are Christian. They are some Christian denomination, but they still practice their traditional religious ceremonies. Then we have maybe 25% or 30% that are traditional Indian religious believers and do not embrace Christianity. And they feel that you cannot embrace Christianity and believe in the Indian religious beliefs that have been for years, that there's a conflict. So anyway, that's kind of the makeup. But regardless of whether an Indian person would say they are Christian or they are traditional Indian, they believe in traditional Indian religion, they all practice the traditional ceremonies. And so that's very significant. And someone asked me yesterday, is there one issue that all tribes could come together and support each other on? And that is one issue, is the Indian Religious Freedom Act. This is one of the most important issues for tribal governments and tribal people throughout the nation, as being able to practice their religious, traditional religion, and to preserve their sacred sites, and also to return the bodies and skeletal remains that are at the Smithsonian. And there's been federal laws that have been passed, and many of tribes have been able to go to the Smithsonian and to identify, I don't know how, they must have, you know, had them tagged that this was a Blackfeet, you know, grave site. Because what they did, this is what the United States government did back, I don't know when, but if they found a grave site, the archaeologists would dig it up, and it had scientific reasons. They would dig up the grave site, take all the artifacts and belongings that was in this grave site, because in the Indian religion, when a person dies, that's why I read from Chief Seattle that their ashes are sacred, and that when they are buried, that they stay there. All their belongings go with them. And that's why the archaeologists and the name for the people that are just out there looking for, you know, Indian artifacts have no regard. There are laws now to protect that people, if they find a burial site, there are federal laws, they can be imprisoned for disturbing them, because the Indians do not want the grave sites disturbed. They do not want the bodies touched. They want everything put back just the way it is. And so trying to get back the skeletal remains and to have from their particular tribe and have a proper burial, this is going on nationally. But there are still many, many skeletal remains in the Smithsonian Museum. And also many very significant medicine bags and religious articles that are in museums that tribes have also tried to recover. So that's still all going on, but that is one issue that all tribal governments and Indian people, I mean, this is the most important issue, because it's like the religion and the beliefs and the customs are all, that is the culture. I mean, it's not segregated, and it's all part of the culture. And so they really view that as, if they do not and cannot preserve their religious beliefs and customs and traditions, then our culture will be gone. I'm gonna have Mark talk about what's what's been going on in terms of religious sites in Washington, because
can
that's
I ask you a question first?
Yes.
What's a medicine wheel to?
Mark has done some extensive study on a medicine wheel, okay. So he's going. I'm gonna let him explain it.
I'll
but
explain it to it in a minute.
Okay.
I'm Mark Premontiel from Skokomish Nation. Ended up, I worked with Native American Lutheran Ministry through ILNAC and the LCA 17 years ago, and have continued on working within Lutheran Church denomination and helping Lutheran Church and Indian people start learning to get along and helping with each other. In Pacific Northwest, a lot of the first issues church has wanted to help Indian was basically social issue, helping the church with Indian people with Indian problems on a social level. One thing what we are doing as we are growing within the church is understanding Lutheran background, Christian background, and trying to get a commonality within church per se. I think the apology, declaration of apology that was just read is a dynamic way of church starting to understand and a way of us gaining a little respect of non-Indian people. What has transpired since this reading, or this writing, in 1987, it was done. We as the Pacific Northwest Indian tribes said it was good that that was written and read to us. But what we as Northwest Native American people were saying was it was another piece of paper. We wanted to have the churches take action for a writing. Our first, we as the Pacific Northwest, the Native American Task Force of the Church Council of Greater Seattle, took on a issue, and the Madrona Point.
Could you spell that, please?
Madrona Point by the Lummi Tribe,
L-U-M-I,
the northern part of Washington State, have a burial ground, and the corporation Weyerhaeuser wanted to build a condominium and a golf course on a known burial site. So the Lummi tribe had come to the Church Council of Greater Seattle and said, okay, here, you wrote a document. Let's see if you can stand beside it and uphold it. Ended up so Lummies are relatives of mine too. I am from the Skokomish Nation, and a lot of the Pacific Northwest tribes are interrelated. Ended up it was a 2-year battle working with both Lummi tribe and the Weyerhaeuser Corporation. And of course, governmental agencies are ones that had to intertwine with that. The battle did win. for the Indian people. The Lummi tribe were able to get back their burial ground and have it for a 99-year lease that they can always extend. So it's returned back to the tribe. They are able to hold on to their burial grounds. When Kathleen mentioned the bones of the Smithsonian, a friend of mine from Lummi ended up going into a museum in Seattle. And being a spiritual leader of Lummi tribe, he could feel the bones of another Lummi person. Those that have spiritual powers will feel the spiritual powers of their own people. He has a very moving story about how he came about that. The battle that was won, they ended up put a feather in the Native American Task Force hat. We decided to look on to another issue that we felt we could try to tackle. As ones that have worked with both tribes and church community. And Snoqualmie Falls, the two Snoqualmie chairmen and co-chairmen had come to us and said that they also needed help as a tribe, that the falls itself is the altar of Northwest Native American people and a burial site for Native American people all the Northwest tribes. Here we are fighting with Puget Power City Light and Warehouse again. Ends up who want to change the structure of the falls and the outlying areas. The falls being an altar of Northwest Indian people, the burial sites of the Indian people of the Northwest, and the destruction of the hillside would change the whole alteration of a person wanting to practice their religious practice. They want to make a condominium and a golf course. A condominium and a golf course, and in the hillside, they want to put a 2,000 housing unit. Those that know the Pacific Northwest, half the falls itself is already more or less recreation area for people. The hillside is the only thing that's still left untouched. This has been about a 2-year battle, yes?
You should tell them that there's already an existing power plant there, and what they want to do is increase the size of that power plant because this falls would make it very easy to generate more power. So yes. There's an existing something there that's
there
already
is a,
disrupted.
Yeah, there is a power plant there, and it ends up what Puget Power City Light want to do is increase the dam size to gain more power and take part of the hillside, which is part of the burial sites, and more or less move them away. So what we are doing in the Native American Task Force of Church Council of Greater Seattle is going against that kind of battle with three different powerhouses. And with the Madrona Point, we went through a 2-year battle. With the Snoqualmie Falls, we are on our 2nd year now. This is that Snoqualmie tribe is a unrecognized tribe federally. So it ends up we are not able to have a little bit of that increased maybe a strong arm as a federally recognized tribe has. The Native American Task Force of the Church Council of Greater Seattle is a, just like any other of the church organizations, nonprofit, and we work on whatever people could give kind of thing. I am glad that I'm here at Holden to see people from other areas of the country, because dam itself is a Federal Energy Regulatory Commission process that they have to go through. So as a federal process that they have to go through, any person that writes to not only the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, our senators, our congressmen, ends up, we are able to, as one voice, stand there and say that we believe in preservation of sacred sites. Its work has been one that we are saying that we think this piece of paper that the church people are wanting to stand behind, then we are gaining part of that respect of you as you are helping us.
Thank you, Mark. It's a very emotional issue.
That's all right.
It really is for Indian people, you know, to talk about these. When we talk about, you know, the burial grounds and what they mean to us as people and our tribal people, I mean, it's very emotional. And there are some federal laws that you know, right now there's some amendments to the Indian Religious Freedom Act which put more enforcement and make it stronger, because it hasn't really been very strong since 1978. And a lot of states are passing, Montana just did that, and I'm sure the state of Washington has a law that on state land or private land, and believe me, this was not an easy bill to get through the legislature. When you start talking about private land, I mean, it's like, hey, you're not going to tell me what to do with my private land. But anyway, the bill did get through, that if a burial site is found or skeletal remains are found on private or state land, that there's a whole process. You have to contact the coroner, you have to contact all these, this committee that includes tribes and officials, archaeologists, state archaeologists, and so on. And they determine who this, you know, skeletal remains is. If it's a Native American, then the tribe that's, you know, if that was their indigenous area, then they can bring their spiritual people, their medicine people there, and rebury the remains in the area, because they do not want to disturb the grave site. If that's necessary, then there's another process. I mean, if it's on private land. But anyway, so that law just went through, and I've been very much involved in it. And just to give you an example why it was necessary to have this kind of law on state or private land, there was a burial site found in some construction site on the Flathead Indian Reservation, and they found, you know, skeletal remains, and it became a circus. I mean, people were there taking pictures and tromping around and digging around, and the tribal spiritual people and medicine people were really upset, you know, that it just became a circus because this was the remains of some ancestor. You know, I mean, just think about it. If I put it in in from your perspective, how would you like a grave of your grandfather or your great-grandfather or mother dug up and have all these people running around it? I mean, you just think about that, how that would... And actually, many of the non-Indian communities supported this bill because we have a lot of ranchers in Montana who've been seven, eight generation ranchers where they have burial sites on their ranches. And they want to make sure that they're protected. So this burial bill didn't just protect Indian burial sites, it also protected burial sites of pioneers and ranchers and families that had family burial plots on their land. And maybe if they sold it or if it became federal land, that it still would be protected. And so that I've been very much involved with that. And I know we're getting close. The one thing that Mark and I wanted to share with you, I couldn't bring all the stuff that I have that's kind of sacred in our ceremonies. And as I mentioned, the ceremonies are different. But we do have some things, some substances that are used by a lot of the tribes use that are important in the religious ceremonies. And one is sweet grass in Montana. I mean, that's very important. Cedar and sage. And that is really kind of used in like purification. It's just, any of you ever been Catholic in this? Okay, so you know when the priest would take the incense and go like this, and I never knew what it was, but you know, it's like kind of purifying you. Well, that's kind of the idea. And so that before a ceremony, the purification from the smoke from the cedar or the sage or the sweetgrass, you're purified, and then they would, some of the tribes, the women would be allowed in the sweat lodges. Chippewas were. Chippewas, women could be spiritual people also and have, be medicine persons, I guess. Some tribes, the women didn't have that role, like the Sioux, for example. The Sioux women did not have a role in the religion part of their tribe. When we were talking about religious sites, also I was thinking of the Sioux in the Black Hills. They still have not accepted, and they won't. The Sioux tribes will not be paid for the Black Hills because that's an extremely sacred site, and it doesn't matter. There's no price on it, and that's still the money has been, I mean, it was a judgment award, and the tribes refused to accept it, and they're a burial site, so that's still ongoing. That's all the Sioux tribes. So, but anyway, the other object that, and I'm not a pipe carrier because you have to be a very spiritual person in your tribe to be a pipe carrier, and you just don't decide that I'm going to be a spiritual person in a tribal or community. I mean, it's something that's a gift, and so only the people that do the pipe ceremonies are very spiritual. They have reached that respect, and they have the spirit to do that. I mean, it's like, and so I always get real offended when you read about it. It's like so much of our culture is being commercialized. Like, oh, come and be a smoke. Enjoy pipe smoking ceremony or a cultural experience. And some of this stuff is just commercialized. Believe me, that only very special people are pipe carriers in the Indian tribes. And so that is used, and that's almost, it's like, it's equivalent to a communion. Yes?
I'm not sure, could you clarify the significance of the burial and the spirituality of what it means for an American Indian? I mean, because for, like, I'm an Episcopalian, and it's not the grave site, it's the life after, the life in heaven that has the significance. Your spirit leaves. Okay, so what's the significance for American Indian?
Okay, well, it would be different for different tribes, but I will talk from the Chippewa. Okay, when a person dies, first of all, it's very important how they are buried. So, you know, I suppose some tribes, they weren't actually, you know, buried underground. The Chippewas were. But they were always buried in a sitting position facing west. All of their important things to them, you know, if, you know, their beaded work or whatever was significant would be buried with them. And then things would be brought to them for 4 days, because their belief was that the spirit did not leave the body until the fourth day. And so then the spirit would go on into, which, you know, I always look at it like heaven, like, you know, with almost like a resurrection, but not of the body. But the body is still important, because, you know, I think when I read that about the ashes are sacred, so if that explains it, at least from the Chippewa, maybe Mark could explain it from his...
Is there a significance in having them facing west? I mean,
yes, well, facing west, because that's everything in almost all the tribes, the circle is extremely important, has very religious importance, beginning and end. And it's like that's the end of your life, your journey. And so you're facing west. And it's like the teepees are always facing east. And like when you would get up and offer your offering of tobacco to the Great Spirit, it would always be in the east. And your teepee would always be facing east. But when your journey is over, I mean, it's just the significance of that we are part of this whole, we are related to everything around us.
The Northwest it goes through the four-day ceremony for the burial, and also the family gets a 1 year mourning time, and we feel it takes 1 year for both the family and the person that has going to pass into the next world needs that time to go into the next world. And we hold the family up for that 1 year, and hold the person that is going through the next year in our minds, in our tradition.
Yes.
When we talk about sacred areas and land, how much in all this issue of preserving an area as a sacred land is wrapped up in the whole business of one culture respecting the other culture? Is that a big component for Indian people to say, we call this sacred and we want you to consider it sacred, and that becomes a sign of one culture respecting the other?
You know, that might have something, but I think that the importance is that that is sacred, and it's like, I think how the Indian people look at it, it's like, okay, churches are considered, these are sacred places, really. And it's like the Indians traditionally didn't have churches, but their churches were, you know, a sacred area. And it's like respect in that way. But it's not an issue of, well, you have to respect what we believe, but it is, you know, internally, from their perspective, that it's important to their existence in terms of their religion continuing. because all Indian religion and stories and all that are oral, and everything has to be done a certain way. I mean, the spiritual people know that because they study it. They, you know, it's passed on through one spiritual person to another. I mean, it's a study. I mean, they know all the herbs. They know, I know in the Chippewa, there's like seven stations where they become like priests. And it's, you know, they have to learn about healing, and they know, I mean, they're herbalists, and then, but it's all passed on. It isn't, and it's only passed on to those chosen few that have the gift. And so, no, I don't think it's just an issue of you have to respect this because we say this is important. I don't think, I mean, it's not that kind of struggle. It's a genuine, from the heart, you know, this is important to us, our existence and our continuation as people.
I work in Washington State, and I work with the Department of Natural Resources, and we have 1,600 employees, and when one of them dies on the workforce, I respond with grief information and such. And we've discovered with the Native Americans that we need to do things differently, and I wonder if you can give us some pointers on that. If we know someone who's a Native American and they have a death in the family, for example, we are used to sending out an agency-wide electronic mail saying one of our employees has died. In the Native American culture, we're not supposed to do that for 4 days because this is the time when their name is not supposed to be mentioned. The gifts that or collections that might be traditionally sent to the American Cancer Society or something, usually the Native Americans will specify very clearly if gifts are given traditionally. You know, in an Anglican culture, we all send money or we wire flowers or something like that. What would a person not familiar with Native American culture do in response to a friend or a coworker who was a Native American who died?
Well, first of all, you know, it's interesting that because you're apparently with a federal or state agency, right? And that I worked with the Bureau of Indian Affairs and mostly Indians, but even that agency did. I mean, their policy in terms of a death in an Indian family, and a death in an Indian family could be, you know, not their mother, their father, someone, you know, it's like, well, it's a real close relative. Because of the extended family, an aunt could be like a mother, or a cousin could be like a brother, and they're just going to go because it's like, you know, they're going to be with their people during this time. And that whole, there's a whole religious ceremony and the wake and all of that is much longer than what the regulations would allow for, you know, a death in the family. And so I think there has to be some real sensitivity to that, you know, without jeopardizing the person's job, because, you know, they're only allowed 3 days for a death and they take off 2 weeks for a death because, you know, this is part of the ceremony and the healing process. But I think that usually, you know, at the wakes, this is the other thing, that the it's always giving. I mean, it's like you're giving something in honor to the family, and Indians give not only just to Indians, but to honor other people too. So, and it's not, you're right, I mean, it's not like money. Well, it could be. Actually, I've seen money given too, but usually,
I don't mind it.
Right? But it's usually star quilts or beaded work or something that, you know, they've worked for a long time making to honor that person. So I don't know. I would just ask the person. I would ask the person because they might have a, you know, something specific. That
is there anything that is clearly offensive that would be culturally customary in an Anglican culture that a Native American would not receive well?
I would talk, like Kathleen mentioned, tribes have different objects and ways of ceremony. I would talk with the tribe or the nation that you're going to be dealing with to work with that. Respect has always been the number one issue with Native American people, and gaining respect. I talked to a couple of you about that with a couple of times with our different people here, and knowing people that are from that tribe and knowing their type of ceremony and asking what is appropriate, what is not.
Maybe if we could, we will show you some of the substances that are used. And it's interesting. I just did some cultural diversity for the police department in Helena, Montana, because we were having an all-Indian rodeo, and we expected 5,000 Indians in town, and they've never been around Indians, because Helena's not, I mean, there's an Indian community, but, you know, it's not like 5,000. And so the one thing I told them, I says, well, first of all, I said, if you find something that looks like this, and it does look like a grassy, green grassy substance, it's probably medicine, or it's probably sweet grass. And I said, and if they have a medicine bag on them, do not disturb it, because he says, well, what should we do? And I said, do not touch their medicine bag, because that has very, could very religious significance
personal,
to them.
Personal.
Yes. So anyway, we'll pass. Did you bring sweet?
I brought just sage.
So we'll just pass this down, and you can just look at it. These are the little seeds, actually, in here of the sweet grass.
It's upside down.
What is the thing in your
back?
What was that thing?
Oh, this is the sweet grass that I'm passing on. This is just the seed of the sweet grass. And that's the sage.
What do they do with it?
Yeah.
They burn it, and it's just you know, put on, you know, like a purifies you.
You normally take a living object like a shell or something from earth, and just like church incenses go around in the church. The Native Americans go around and incense the people that want to receive that blessing.
You're going to say something about that wheel?
Yeah. Oh, the medicine wheel teachings is I took a 2-year course on it, but it ends up, it's a course of a lifetime of learning. It's from the Lakota tradition, Tekashala, the Great Spirit God, is the center of the medicine wheel. And there are 12 different animal spirits. There are 12 different plant spirits. There are 12 different mineral spirits. There are 4 different messengers that help the person get to the Kashala, and finding yourself on the medicine wheel, where you are and what the time of year is, and working your way within that wheel, you understand Tekashala. It's religious background. They say the beginning of time is the origin of the medicine wheel for the people that have brought that religion to the people.
Mark, would you say something about the 4 directions?
Okay, the 4 directions. Ends up between, they go normally east, what is it now?
South.
East, north, south, or east, what, east, north, west, south. And the directions are not only in different ways, you're like the medicine wheel, a transition of your life cycle. And east being your birth, your childhood. Actually, I'm going maybe backwards, but it ended up north would be the ending time of your age. And medicine wheel colors of the four directions are different with different tribes. Normally red, yellow, black, and white are the ones I've known most predominantly, because they are the colors of the races of the world. And what they do is stand there and say, there are basically four races of people on Earth, and if we do not look toward the Kashala as our center, if we do not believe in our God, then the people of Earth are not going to be able to survive.
I need to keep this on schedule, and we are over.
A book that can be skimmed through that I'll be staying here for a while. So. And I was going to say, in the other room, I thought we were going to be in. I have a little bit of my material here with me, and it ended up, people can read it and then leave it, and then other people can read it.